Good morning, church. It is so good to see you all and be with you all, as always. Sunday mornings are a special time here at Forest Mill, and if you are visiting with us today, then you just got a taste of why Sunday mornings are special for us. To have good men like David up here doing announcements and Marcus doing our Lord's Supper devotional, just really appreciated what they had to say, and I really appreciate what Tommy did in leading our minds in worship. Just a lot to be thankful for. If you were here last night, you saw maybe a different side of Forest Mill. It was the Forest Mill Fun Night, first ever that I am aware of. It was called the Forest Mill Fun Night, and they had all sorts of games and competitions, and I hear that congratulations are in order for our watermelon seed spitting champion. Could you raise your hand? Are you here today? Oh, there he is, Jackson Hibden. Y'all give him a... Very well done. I appreciate your mother teaching you to spit like that. And anyway, that was a lot of fun. I know they had a big time, and I'm so thankful for those who worked hard to make this possible and such a success. Now, in 2 weeks, I want to tell you that we're starting something new. Starting in 2 weeks, we're going to have what we're calling, a new Bible class we're calling Forest Mill 101. And it's going to be meeting on Sunday mornings in the cafeteria, and it's for people who are new to the Bible or new to faith, or you're just new to Forest Mill. And in this class, it's a 13-week class. We're going to kind of walk through some of the basic tenets of faith, but we're also going to walk through our congregation so that if you're new here, you'll get to know some folks and you'll get to kind of learn about some places you can serve and your role within the congregation, kind of what's expected of you as a part of Forest Mill. And if you have come in the last year, we especially are targeting you with this. If you have become a Christian last year, or if you've been new to our congregation within the last year, we're especially targeting you with this class. But if you're like, well, I don't really know some of that stuff, and I'd like to come as well, you're welcome to come. It's going to be Sunday mornings, 9 o'clock, in the cafeteria area, and I'll be teaching that class. But I'm really looking forward to kind of getting into that. That's in 2 weeks, the first Sunday in August. We'll start in August. Think we're starting that class same time school starts back, so to speak, with the first Sunday in August. We're going through the Gospel of Mark on Sunday mornings. We come to this point in Mark's Gospel where it's tempting for us, if you follow the story of the disciples, we're at the point, at least for me, where it would be really tempting to sort of write the disciples off because they're just a bunch of screw-ups. I mean, they continue to fail time and again. They don't get anything right. They don't see Jesus for who he is. They don't listen to Jesus with an open mind. They don't say the right things. They don't do the right things. In short, they keep doubting Jesus. That's their big issue. So we have to ask the question, is it reasonable to doubt? Is it reasonable to have doubt? There was a defendant who was on trial for murder, and the lawyer who was representing him was kind of up against it. There was a lot of strong evidence indicating his client's guilt, a lot of witnesses and all sorts of things that pointed towards his client's guilt, but there was no body. And so as he's closing his case out, in his closing statement, the lawyer decided to try a little bit of a trick for his client's behalf. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I have a surprise for you all." As he looked at the jury box, he then looked down his watch. He said, "In exactly 1 minute, the supposed victim is going to walk through the doors of this courtroom." So he held up his watch and watched the jury as well as they all turned to look at that door, to see who was going to come walking through. And even though the jurors were baffled, they did all look. And finally the lawyer said, "Well, actually I have a confession to make. I made up that previous statement.
But I did it to prove that you all have a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant actually killed this person, whether that person's even dead. The fact that you looked shows you have reasonable doubt. So please return a verdict of not guilty. So the jury was dismissed. They go back to deliberate. 10 minutes later, they come back out, and they pronounce the verdict of guilty. The lawyer is incensed. The defense lawyer is incensed. He says, but how? You know, you had to have some doubt. I saw you all turn and look to that door to see if that person was coming walking through. And one of the jurors spoke up and said, yes, sir, we did, but your client did not. So, there are certain times when doubt is unreasonable. But if we're honest with ourselves this morning, at least all of us who are Christians and have a little bit of maturity about us, I think we would all admit that we've doubted. At some point or another, maybe even this morning, you're wrestling with doubts. And yet, on the whole, despite the fact that we've all had our doubts, I think we could also say that Christianity in general, the church the world over, has not handled doubt very well. We've often said that or thought of doubt as a sign of weakness. If you have doubts, then you're not as strong as you should be. So if you are struggling with faith this morning, and I want you to know that you have come to the right place, and that if you have doubts, especially if you have doubts, you have come to the right place, because you are surrounded by people who have had doubts themselves, people who have waffled and wavered and yet come back time and again to Jesus. So it's that kind of faith that we're going to sort of witness this morning as we dig into our text. Now, this text from Mark chapter 9, it's after the transfiguration event, after Jesus goes up on the mountain with his disciples, and they see him with Elijah and Moses, just a miraculous event. And they are surrounded. Jesus comes back with James and John and Peter, and they come back, and the other disciples are sort of surrounded and embroiled in an argument with some of the teachers of the law. So when Jesus shows up, this full argument's already ongoing, the crowd, the disciples, the teachers of the law, they all turn to Jesus like, hey, you've got to solve this. And as it turns out, this controversy that they are in Jesus' absence, is over a failed healing. This father of a sick boy goes on to describe the symptoms of his son's demonic possession, he calls it. It makes his son unable to speak. It gives him seizures. It causes him at times to foam at the mouth. So you and I, from a modern perspective, we're looking at it and we're like, that may sound like some symptoms of a disorder like epilepsy or something along those lines. But Mark makes it very clear this is not just a biological or physical or a brain disorder. That there's more going on than just these physical symptoms, that there is, in fact, an evil spirit. So the disciples, in Jesus' absence, had tried to drive this spirit out, but they had been unsuccessful, hence all the controversy in Jesus' absence, hence the argument. You know, likely he got the teachers of the law, they're looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. His disciples try to cast out a demon from a kid who is obviously sick. They can't do it, and so there they are to pounce, like, aha, we knew that you all were not what you were claiming to be. That could not be true. The fact that you can't heal this kid is just proof that your master does not have power. So that's probably the gist of the argument that was going on. And at this point, Jesus steps in and he takes over. And Jesus asks the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It's often thrown him in the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, Jesus said, everything is possible for one who believes. And immediately the father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, You spirit that keeps the boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, and his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? And he replied, that kind can only come out by prayer. Now, all of this is linked together. And so Mark here, he is stressing two complementary issues. I think it's two issues that you'll see why they go together. The two complementary issues are desperate straits, you know, struggle that is real, desperate straits, and wavering faith. Times are hard and faith wavers. Desperate straits and wavering faith go together like peanut butter and jelly. They were just meant to be together. When things aren't going right and when you don't have all the answers or know what to do, that's when it is hard to have faith, isn't it? Our faith in God is challenged by difficult circumstances. When you or someone you love is sick and not getting well, when you or someone you love is going through relationship problems that don't seem to be getting any better and maybe, in fact, getting worse, or financial problems or problems with a job, or when they're dealing with life events that are too big for them and you just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. When you're in the thick of it, it is really hard to have faith. We want to believe, and we do believe. But that faith that we have really wavers when the storm comes. It's hard to have faith when money is tight, and there's an easy way to fix it if you can just fudge the truth a little bit. It's hard to have faith when the people around you don't have faith and they seem to be getting on just fine. It's hard to have faith when you don't know what to do or where to go. Or even harder still, when you've been doing the right thing and it's not getting any better. You know, like this father, for instance. He's raised his son. Obviously, he loves him. He's watched his son struggle. He's watched his son hurt. He's watched his son battle just to get by. He knows what it's like to watch your son be shunned and rejected, to have your parenting questioned because of the way he has turned out. What kind of father raises a child who struggles like this, right? And yet when Jesus comes near, he has enough faith, enough desperation to seek Jesus out. But now, at this point, this now, he's already been through a failed healing, right? He seeks Jesus out. Jesus is away. He's up on the mountain with Peter, James, and John. The other disciples are like, yeah, we can cast out demons. We've done it before. And then your son, for whatever reason, they can't heal your son. So now he's hurt yet again. He got his hopes up, had his hopes dashed, right? So Jesus' followers, his disciples, had tried and failed. So when he comes to Jesus, his doubt of Jesus sounds pretty reasonable from my vantage point. Your disciples, you trained your disciples to cast out demons. They've done it before, but it's not working on my boy. Maybe my boy's different. Maybe my boy's worse. Maybe I'm a worse dad. Maybe I did worse things to make this happen. All of those doubts start cycling through, right? So his doubt, to me, feels pretty reasonable. But here's Jesus. Because people's understanding of Jesus is often shaped by the people of Jesus. Does that make sense? What you do or do not do, as a Christian, what you do or do not do shapes other people's view of Jesus. That's your job. You and I are faith shapers. We talk to friends or family members or neighbors or people in the community or old high school friends or whatever, and they know you're a Christian. How you talk, or don't talk, how you act or don't act, what you do or don't do, you shape their view of Jesus. And this guy's view, this father's view of Jesus has been shaped by failed disciples. So is it any wonder that he's doubting Jesus? Jesus' closest followers could not heal his son. So to me, his doubt feels very reasonable. This father had been disappointed by the likes of you and me. So maybe healing was too much to hope for. And it's not just the father's faith that's wavering. Jesus says, calls this entire generation. Says the entire generation, not just this man, but everyone, including his disciples, calls them faithless. It was like this father's failure and his disciples' failure are not isolated events. They are just symptoms of a much bigger problem. And here lies the difference between this story of demonic possession and some of the others in Mark. If you're reading through the Gospel of Mark, by the way, you'll see this is not the first time Jesus has come across someone who's got a demon-possessed spirit. Not the first time. The difference is how the story's told. Early in Mark, at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, we're told about how Jesus can heal these people who have demon possession. And it's told to prove a point, the point being Jesus can do that. That he's not just some teacher, he's not just some prophet, that he is in fact a special emissary from God that they have never seen before. That Jesus can do that. It's to prove his power over all of nature. That's the reason for the stories at the first of Mark. We're not at the beginning of Mark anymore, brothers and sisters. We're in the middle here. We're in the thick of it. And in the thick of it, this story of demon possession is not to prove that Jesus can heal a demon-possessed child. He's already done that. We already know he can. This is not to prove that he can do it, but that we doubt he can do it. This story is not to illustrate Jesus' power, but the disciples' lack of faith. Yes, it is still the healing of a sick kid who is deaf and unable to speak and got seizures and all of that. But at this point, it is the 12 disciples who have been stumbling all over themselves, and they're increasingly unable to listen to Jesus and believe Jesus and say what Jesus would say. Their failure to heal, you imagine the scene, by the way. Here they are, they're like, well, Jesus is in here right now, but we can do it, and we know how to do this. And so the father brings the child, and you might think, well, maybe they said the wrong words. Maybe you've felt that way before. Someone's come to you with a question about church or about Jesus or about your faith, someone was like, you're like, I don't know what to say. I don't have the right words. I don't know all the rituals. I don't have book, chapter, and verse ready on my mind. I can't do this. I cannot answer. I cannot give you a solution. And we might be tempted to think that's what happened with the disciples. They just didn't have the right things to say. They didn't have the right formula. They didn't have the right memorization, whatever. But Jesus makes it clear that their failure wasn't because they didn't say the magic words. Their failure was not because they hadn't seen it done before or even done it themselves before. Their failure was because they didn't even have enough faith to pray. They did not even have enough faith to pray. Church, I don't know if you've ever read the Gospel of Mark and thought about it isolated from the other Gospels, but here's a little news flash for you in the Gospel of Mark. The disciples never pray in Mark. They never pray. You know how we've been frustrated at their lack of faith and they're saying the wrong things and doing the wrong things and doubting Jesus and everything. They never even have enough faith to pray. In fact, when Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, he's like, you come with me, you pray with me. They can't even do that. They never have enough faith to pray. We often think of prayer as communicating with God, like telling God something maybe he doesn't know. But prayer is not about telling God what you want or what you think or what you've been through. Prayer before God, especially in the Gospel of Mark, is about aligning our will with God's will, not aligning his will with ours. Prayer in the Gospel of Mark is acknowledging our dependence on, our need for God. And that's exactly what his disciples have failed to do. They have failed to acknowledge that they depend on God. Here's the thing. We read this story. It's a familiar story. We like this story. And you and I, it doesn't take us very long at all to know this boy needs healing, right? We hear the symptoms. We're like, that kid needs healing. We know that. Everyone who was there with Jesus, they know that too. They're all standing in the crowd, and if you had asked the question, if you and I had been there, and we'd said, hey, who needs healing? Every finger would have been pointed at this obviously struggling young man. We would have all said it. But that's not who needs healing in this story. You know who needs healing in this story? The Father. The disciples. Everybody else. Yes, the young man has these physical things that are not right. But the problem that Jesus is really confronted with here is not this young man's symptoms, it's their lack of faith. This boy's father and the disciples need to be healed from their lack of faith. And like Jesus' followers, like this dad as well, we can just limp along on the bare essentials of faith. You know what this, it's like? We can get just the basics. I believe Jesus is the Son of God, and just hang on to that and say, that's my rudimentary faith. And you can hang on to that little bitty tiny sliver of the basics of faith, and you can hang on to that and have that your whole life as long as everything continues to go your way. That'll be enough. Now, how many of you have had a life so far that everything's gone your way? Just raise your hands high, because I'm here to tell you you're at the wrong church if everything has gone your way. Because when your life goes sideways, when things aren't going your way, when you don't know how to fix all that you've broken, that small faith won't cut it. What you need is not the basics of faith. You need life-changing faith. Not just to believe, but to be healed from your unbelief. I think sometimes we get the confused notion that I became a Christian, and so I got this like a status, like my status went from lost to saved, and we just can stay in one of those two places. Church, when you became a Christian, that was not the end of your faith journey. That's the beginning of your faith journey. That's where you start. That's where you start, not where you finish. You've got so much more to do. And the Jesus disciples, just this father, they believed. They just didn't have enough to overcome their unbelief. They had some faith. They didn't have life-changing faith. So you have to be able to hit that point where your faith is big enough to push, you know, to take a poker metaphor, which, of course, we do not advocate in the Forestville Church of Christ, but to take all your chips and shove them into the middle of the table. And if you know what that is, you need to repent. To take all your chips, to shove them into the middle of the table and say, God, I don't know how things are going to work out. I'm not holding a great hand here, but I'm betting on you, and I'm betting on you alone. I'm not betting on my abilities. I'm not betting on my talents. I'm not betting on my past. I am betting on you. I know I don't have enough faith yet, but God, I want to have enough faith. I want that kind of faith. Heal me, God, from my unbelief. Yeah, we're an amen in church. Where's my little guy? There he is. Church, we all know people who need healing. Sometimes physical, sometimes mental, emotional, financial, relational. We all know folks who need healing. But until we acknowledge the places in our heart where we hang on to unbelief, we're the ones who stand in the greatest need. So my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is that we might be a church who is healed from our unbelief. That we might start exhibiting, at the very beginning, the faith of this father. Just the desire to have more. To be healed from our unbelief. And that we might grow to have that life-changing faith that Jesus desires. If we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up. We want you to know that your doubt, your unbelief is not a barrier to future faith. And so if we can do that for you this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?